This podcast presentation is brought to you by Creative Disturbance, a project from the RSI Lab of the University of Texas at Dallas. The following podcast contains instances of strong language, mature content, and disturbing premises. User discretion is advised.
Hi, my name is Matej Vakula, and this is BioCollider. BioCollider podcast had been around for a while, for about 2 years, but this is the first time we are working with Creative Disturbance, and we are really glad to become part of their channels. BioCollider is a podcast about connections between humans, non-humans, intelligence, machines, biology, art, philosophy, technology, games, fiction, and politics. BioCollider is a place where science from top research institutions meets art and philosophy. I hope you'll enjoy the podcast. As a first guest on our Creative Disturbance collaboration, I'm bringing you bioartist Adam Zaretsky. I have known Adam for quite a short time personally, but he's around bioart for a really long time. He's a wet lab practitioner mixing ecology, biotechnology, human and non-human relations, body performance, and gastronomy. He has been a fairly controversial figure in the field of bioart, and his topics of interest are Fragan species invasions, radical food science, jazz bioinformatics, tissue culture, transgenic design issues, ethology, and physiology. He is a former researcher at the MIT Department of Biology, and for the past decade, Zaretsky has been teaching an experimental bioart class called Vivo Arts at San Francisco State University, Symbiotica at University of Western Australia, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, University of Leiden's, the Arts and Genomics Center, and with the Vaag Society. He also taught at NYU, Carnegie Mellon, and runs a public life art school, VASTL, the Vivo Arts School for Transgenic Aesthetics Limited. His art focuses on an array of legal, ethical, social, and libidinal implications of biotechnological materials, methods, with a focus on transgenic humans.
All right, so so Adam, I would like you to say something about collaboration. What does collaboration what role does it play in your artwork? How does it connect for you in the, you know, overall like bio art connection between bio art and collaboration?
Well, okay. So listen, the first thing that I would say is my major collaborators are not human. And if they are human, I'm trying to turn them into something or someone or to birth a non-human. My major collaborators are life, the life world. Sometimes that's collaboration, and sometimes that's just usury and trying to distinguish the difference. Trying to distinguish the difference between collaboration and usury is difficult in bioart because bioartists use life. They call themselves designers sometimes. They call themselves do-it-yourself citizen scientists. They don't usually call themselves like life users as artists. To be able to distinguish between using and working with life is sometimes difficult because you can't totally ask a life form Would you like to work with me on this project? I'm thinking of mutating your genome. Who knows? Your descendants might be worthy of a museum. I don't think most fungi or insects or fish or human embryos really have a decent response to that kind of question. Would you trade one genome trajectory for some graffiti artist's signature fame-induced heavy-handedness in making your genome have a different trajectory in the name of being put on a pedestal in a shitty bell jar for a crappy installation that looks like it could just be a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? It might be better BioWare. So sometimes I work with organisms as opposed to working with organisms. When you work with an organism, you do something like play frisbee with your dog, right? You do something like painting with elephants or dancing with wolves. When you work with an organism, sometimes you give your art to the organism. This would be like non-human enrichment art, sometimes referred to as trans-species art, where people make like a bridge over the freeway for live animals to be able to cross the freeway without getting hit by cars. That's sort of like in line with preserving keystone species and kind of deep ecology. If you make games for pets, like a popular corporate store might make just pet toys, that's a award-winning, economically feasible thing, because pets are bored suburbanite animals and they need entertainment. Well, so do other animals that are in captivity, right? And this includes animals in zoos, animals stuck in parks, because parks are actually like similar to our human zoos. We have non-human zoos. They're called parks. Maybe even humans as animals that are stuck kind of in captivity in suburbia need enrichment. You know, that's why we have these cell phones. That's why we have the Netflix palette. That's why we have endless cereals right now, is because there's really nothing else to do. We're kind of in jail, in the jail of our own making. And certainly people in jail and in refugee camps need animal enrichment because A, humans are animals, and B, they are being treated like animals. I went to Basel, not for Art Basel, but for something called Black Box, and it was actually making art with refugees that were in a refugee camp just over the border in Basel, and they were being kept in the jail. But during the day, everyone that was there as a refugee was let out of the jail into the park for a couple of hours, maybe in between meals, right?
I think I saw it.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful program. And I tried to do some collaboration. I was talking about enriching animals. So I put a speaker. I started to dig a hole in the earth to put a speaker in to talk to the land. But it turned out that none of the refugees were allowed to work. So they would release them out into Switzerland with no money and no chance at work. And so mostly this residency was providing tea and coffee and sometimes like things to sit on and some soccer balls or something. And some artists would come and try to spice it up a little bit. Turned out that everybody wanted to dig the hole. Nobody, they were like, you're an artist. You know how to dig a hole. We got the hole and the speaker got put in the ground and people took the microphone and they started, everybody had something else to say. You know, they might talk to the Swiss and they might talk to Europe, or they might sing, an Eritrean song or some kind of Tibetan thing. And almost we had to set up a sort of shade for people because it was too sunny. And then it started looking like a funeral, and it kind of got deep. Not my intention, but it got deep. So there's that sort of collaboration. Also, eco art is often in collaboration with the earth or in collaboration with natural forces. Maybe not that naive. Sometimes like a spiral jetty It's actually dressing up a super fun site with something that says, you know, we could have had a lot more fun than this. So it's not always just peachy eco art. Sometimes eco art has got a hard edge, a tactical edge. But the other arts that involve life, arts that involve food, arts that involve biology, they're a little more heavy-handed. And I guess the arts that use the human body, like performance art, they're actually almost also thoughtful, because at least you're going to hurt yourself or your friends, at least you're doing it with their permission, as opposed to, I would say, bio art and food art really suck for collaboration. Like I would, if someone said, do you want to be in a bio art piece or a food art piece where you are the biology or you are the food? I would have to think hard and ask really a lot of questions before I wanted to be the life in someone else's art that way, because bio art on the whole is pretty much using life as a medium in total usury. Like instead of playing frisbee with your dog, you would cut your dog's head off and make monoprints with its neck, right? And be like, look at the art I made with this dog. That's a different kind of width, right? So when I look at, say, tissue culture art, or transgenic art, or art that uses experimental laboratory methods, it's generally like science. It's a one-way street towards death if you enter into that wager, right? Now, a lot of people are using yeast or E. coli or plants. For instance, I have some plants right here, these little ones here. Those are GMO plants. They're not supposed to be outside. Indeed, if they were outside, which they're not, they're on my porch. It's different. They're double contained.
Which is enclosed with glass.
Oh, yeah. They're enclosed with glass and my words. I'm containing them with my words. Stay. Stay. That's double containment, so we're safe. But in general, if I wanted to take them outside, I'd either need a permit or I'd need to kill them to take them outside.
What kind of GMOs are they?
Oh, they're fucked up. I mean, they were mustard plants. It's called Arabidopsis thaliana. It's a standard workhorse of molecular biology. It was the first plant to be sequenced. It's a precursor because it grows so fast and makes so many seeds. It's a precursor to working with, say, rice or corn or sorghum, these sort of grains that people, and also big crops like palm oil trees and things like that. But these plants have been whole genome reprogrammed in two directions at once. I call them bipolar. Their gene expression patterns, like their genes remain the same as what was contained in their genome before, but in over 500 places on their genome, the expression patterns have been changed. Upregulated, downregulated, which means like, you know, if I say milk to you and you hear the word milk and you're kind of a sensitive person when it comes to language, you may actually begin to produce something like lactic acid to digest milk. Some people aren't that susceptible to language, to biochemistry, but if I gave you a piece of cheese, the cheese itself initiates the gene for lactic acid to overproduce or upregulate. You don't produce stuff that digests milk every second. You just wait for the milk to show up and then your body responds. It's as if the genome was not you, in so much as it was a library to be used by your body in different conditions. In other words, it's not the center. It's sort of like this storage room for accessing unusual situation reactions, like erotism or grief or slow and disastrous itching, or I don't know, response to advertisements, which is really like the other side of the nature-nurture debate, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, how will this advertisement change your gene expression patterns? It's really important because, believe it or not, who you are, if you think your identity is your genes, which is sad if you do. It's just fetishism. But indeed, your gene expression patterns can be influenced by things like piss poor bad advertising being repeated over and over in your face. And that's like a lot of what's going on. It's not just inbred, but it can be trained. Oof. So you can lose both ways.
Enough repetition and sort of subliminal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a strange thing to say that you can be trained behaviorally and genetically in the same ways. But there's no real difference. It's mm-hmm. sort of awful. I'm sorry. So anyway, these plants are officially, we are not sure if they are still plants, because some of the places that the alteration for up and down regulated landed may have turned on or turned off or overexpressed or underexpressed genes that haven't been, well, some genes that may have been expressed that haven't been expressed in millions of years. They've been laying dormant, atavistically strained inside of like some sort of compartmentalized, maybe in case of emergency, break glass here genes. And if one of these upregulators lands right before that gene, well, it may be from back when it was a protozoa, not a plant. It may be some kind of gene that hasn't been used in any other organism except lizards. So this plant may be part protozoa lizard at this point. I'm not sure. But it's a little late to ask the seeds if they would have liked to collaborate, right? They're bound for the pedestal.
It's almost like the multi-species is already in that plant, and you're kind of communicating with that.
Uh-huh, drawing it out, yeah. Well, yeah, there is a question. Maybe I'm just a zoophiliac, right? Mm. So, I've been writing a little bit lately for a book that's due to come out through Routledge. My editor, Hannah, who I look up to a lot, put me on task for writing about the twins that were born in Shenzhen. The scientist sort of went somewhat rogue with quite a lot of support from the US and the UK in China in the area of Shenzhen and made some, the first two transgenic humans that are official. I'm sure there have been transgenic humans made before, but these were the first ones to go public. He sort of said, Lulu and Nina, not their real names, have been born and have a gene knocked into them that, both will help them be somewhat resistant to AIDS and possibly has enhanced their memory and analytical thinking. I'm curious about this gene, actually. It's something I've been looking into as an aesthetic, because what I really study, like on a deep level for myself, is like, what is the aesthetics of the future human? And who's going to decide? And is there such a thing as a better human? Like, people use the word genetic enhancement mm-hmm. as if that was a simple term. For me, it's super not.
Human 2.0 and all of this stuff, yeah.
Yeah, this mm-hmm. this transhumanism and transhumanism seems like almost like Scientology, completely convinced that optimism will bring us to utopia. And I come from the other side of the tracks. First of all, utopia isn't something that you should just strive for blindly, and certainly not through feel-good methods, because I've seen a lot of attempted utopias fail, and I've seen a lot of utopias that were succeeding on optimism alone and turned into some of the greatest foibles of human history. So I'm suspicious. In fact, I think we should look into genes for being suspicious as a form of enhancement. And if we're going to enhance the human, we have to think about what it really might need. Because we're lacking in so many areas. Some people just want to cure mortality and then they'll work with the rest. And I'm like, that's not good enough. for one thing, I don't really want to live forever. I like death. I like the one-way street. I like cycles. I like being part of major mega cycles. And I want to feed myself to flora, you know? But besides that, it just feels like maybe we want to look deeply at the range of what humans can become, at the point in which we are not plastic enough to become our dreams, and also to not grow ourselves into some sort of idiotic monoculture based on bigger brains and bigger dicks, bigger tits, and that somehow everything will work out. Longer life, bigger tits, bigger dicks, bigger brains is not the answer to me. I think that more caterpillary, you know, fuzzier, stranger orange, bergamot scented elbow testicles. So I just have a lot of questions. So when it comes to these twins, though, I've been writing them a letter. It's kind of nice to like sort of couch this in instead of like, oh, this is going to happen or this is happening, is like, how is it for you two to be alive? You know, here's what people said they were doing and here's what I think they actually were doing. I think they had a giant orgy on your embryos, you know, a giant science fetish orgy, kind of a medical fuck fest. And they came up with you as sort of the star bio art for their productive reproductive facility, you know, and so I'm kind of getting in on that. We'll see how that goes. I hope that those kids are okay, but I hope they also are able to hear some of the subaltern voices that call to them that aren't just going to tell them that they're miracle babies, but also going to tell them that, well, you know, if you live long enough to reproduce without getting cancer for what they did to you, you're going to have to come to terms with the fact that the genes they put in with you were chosen for propaganda reasons. You know, they were to fight a disease that could be fought other ways as an excuse to put in an enhancement gene that enhances you in a very specific way. And unfortunately, that has to do with the cult of Western logic, right? So they went for the frontal lobes. They went for analytical thinking. This is a gene actually that's prominent in many people in Western Europe and many Ashkenazi Jews. And being an Ashkenazi Jew, I have this funny feeling that it's the gene that makes me hyper-analytical, but it also is a problem gene. It makes me hyper-neurotic. It makes me succumb too quickly to bad humor. You know, like borscht belt humor. And I have a funny feeling that they actually made kids that are going to be more neurotic, right? So this is not, to me, it may be enhancement still, but it's like, if you got this gene, you might just end up a bad comedian with horrible neurotic problems. And that's codified in Western Europe as having great memory and being super analytical. I'm like dubious, just saying, I'm a little dubious. So that I think that article should be okay.
Yeah, those kids, it's also like some people even questioned how successful the genetic edit was even. Was it successful or like the...
Okay, look, right now we're in the middle of a CRISPR propaganda revolution. It's preposterous. Okay. What people have said is that CRISPR is more accurate and more targeted as far as where it lands in the genome than any other method of transgenesis ever before. That might be true, but the off-target mutations that CRISPR causes are many. The fact that CRISPR often breaks entire chromosomes is just a notable fact. What scientists say when you ask them, scientists in the know, they say, we're looking for a safe harbor in the human genome to put a USB port because CRISPR is that accurate. And then you say, what about the chromosomal breakage? And what about the off-target mutations? And they say, we're working on refining those problems. One of the major problems is that if you put something into someone's genome and it's a mistake, it's hard to find. It's invisible. It's very tiny. And it can be, at a certain point, attributable to natural variation and not to the technique itself. So there's a lot of ways to say, eh, good enough, right? And when it comes to congenital disease, maybe it is good enough. I don't know about the cult of trying to save every embryo from congenital disease, but when it comes to trying to sell parents perfect pitch so their kids don't have to take piano lessons, putting genes into an embryo seems a little heavy-handed. You know, it's still dangerous. It still causes probably more sickness than it cures.
And sometimes the good enough is basically is springs up or starts up the whole advertising process around the new technology and over like advertised, and everything is just fluff basically around it, right?
Yeah, it's to sell stock. Yeah, you know, it's to sell science, you know, as like a cartoon of itself.
Sometimes it's super hard to even find like the, I don't even know. I wanted to say almost truth, but like it's not really the correct word.
I know what you're saying. If you don't go with the program, you're poo-pooed and they compare you to an anti-vaxxer or a Luddite just for being critical and analytical. If they're making these kids that have better analytical skills and they're not ready for analytical people to be critical, then they're shooting themselves in the foot. They should make people that are dumber and find the gullible gene and put that in to enhance humans to become the kind of humans they're looking for. I would say this. This type of research is going on very often. A lot of it is just in hospitals, just in laboratories. But there are other places. There are places that study reproductive endocrinology. There are places that study infertility. And people that are desperate go there. My hormones are off. I'm not fertile. What can you do? And that's a place that they get hooked. IVF clinics. Even gynecologists, obstetricians will sometimes take a sample, sometimes take your eggs, maybe keep the extras for medical research. People offering their wombs on the market right now, you can buy 10, 20 surrogate mothers at once if you want a big family. There's even waste from abortion clinics is being used for biomedical research. So if you have an abortion, yeah, they might take the embryonic stem cells and put them into, something for healing wounds like burns. And that's great. That's great. I'm sorry if you don't like the ghost of your dead non-baby that you didn't want being used to heal people who've had like fire damage to their face. It is kind of uncanny to think that a portion of your aborted fetus is alive on someone's face. But on the other hand, that's a good use for baby parts or pre-baby parts. But I think embryonic stem cells should be available as a face cream for everyday use for everybody. But if they take those embryonic stem cells and grow them and mix them with sperm and let them grow into embryoid bodies, they have a clone army from one unwanted and rightfully chosen, you know, aborted pre-being to 1 million army strong clone, you know, bastion of somebody else's giant weird breeding project. So I would just say like there's areas where medical waste, like even people that die in a car crash, they might grab their ovaries. They might grab their testicles and bring them into zygotes and bring them into embryos and kind of put genes in. And then sometimes these products, you know, these donated products, these organs, turn into even, how do I say this? It sounds strange, but International Space Station experiment. So we have human embryonic stem cells. We have human embryonic stem cells in orbit around us right now, a low orbit, and they're kind of just cruising around us in space, being tested for their resilience in microgravity for future space travelers. So it's good to remember that parts is parts. It's also good to remember that everybody has this sort of like non-self portion of their body, their gonads, their germline. Not everyone. Some people have had a hysterectomy. Some people were born without testicles. But that testicles and ovaries contain seeds for future generations, and those seeds are being harnessed. The flesh of those seeds are being harnessed. Almost, it's almost as if the human body is the last to be colonized. We colonized every other facet of the earth, the crust deep into the ground mining. We've harnessed labor with technology, but we haven't harnessed the human body properly. We actually are the fly in the ointment. That's why everyone's excited about AI and robotics, because we can finally get rid of humans as too messy, too illogical. But the truth is, I think what's going to happen is that there's going to be a strong movement to engineer people to become as rational as machines. And that would mean we'd be born probably cubist. We'd be born able to take long, detailed orders through USB chips, you know, this type of thing, but also that our genome itself would be responsive, in particular, responsive to keys. Okay, so this is where we're getting kind of interesting. There's something called optogenetics that I've been reading about. It's sort of lovely, this lovely effect. Some people have this dream to be able to use their mind as a remote control to control the outside world, to have their mind somehow connected to a controller. And then you'd be able to not have to use your hands. You could keep driving and you could make things happen.
It's the ultimate idea of power.
Yeah. Sort of like telekinesis, right? But it goes the other way. They figured out how to make certain cells, even certain neurons, turn on or turn off, in response to light waves. And the light waves are, powerful enough laser light waves that they could actually go through, say, like a bird skull, maybe even eventually a human skull. And that would mean that you'd have a part of your mind that would be engineered to only turn on in response to a light, a certain wavelength of light. And when that wavelength hit that part of your brain, you would enact a sort of program, what they call a program, a flesh-based psychic metamorphosis that probably would again turn off after a certain amount of time. And this is perfect for, say, future Manchurian candidates. This is perfect for future sleeper cell assassins that don't know who or what they are and don't know what or how they did what they did. So this would be fantastic. You could have an army that didn't know it was an army. You just shine a light and they go on rampage, berserker, and then come back and ask for a bag of chips. You know, there will be no PTSD. We've erased PTSD. So this is obviously a health-based program. And that I like. I like to see health being advanced for people. So, in any case, I like to let people know how genes are getting into their cells, where people are doing this, you know, whether it's at the bedside or in the lab. So I'm kind of, I don't know, I've been working on showing methods of transgenesis for a few years. And I started with microinjection, and then I moved into electroporation and then biolistics. I've had a couple of labs on lipofection. And these are all different ways of getting genes into the center of the nuclei of cells. Different actual physical mechanical ways of getting genes in to the center of the donut, the jelly donut, you know, to take your payload, your quote unquote program, and jam it into a genome, you have to get it near the genome. And to get it there, you can inject it. You can shoot it with a gun. You can take the DNA and zap it in. You can even mix it with fat and just let it soak in like some kind of moisturizer, right? And so I've had labs for the past few years that are basically on methods of transgenesis. That's what I did it in Moscow. I did it all over the place. And so I'm getting closer to a place where I think I have to really study how to culture human embryonic stem cells and actually make some up-to-date CRISPR transcripts for genes that are a little off the Richter scale of what anyone would actually want to do with the human genome. You know, go and find some mango DNA and mix it with some dinosaur DNA and see if I can make a mango dinosaur insert for the human genome. Even making people have skin that kind of looks like acid bath denim. You know, really bad taste. I want to get some bad taste out there as available.
I like acid bath denim.
Yeah, acid bath denim skin. You'll blend in at the gap. You know, it's good camouflage. I'm resistant to enhancement alone. There are people that just want to make humans stronger, just want to make them more intelligent, have longer lifespans, but also better memory, heal faster, be resistant to any kind of weapon that the military can invent, especially deadly biowarfare diseases. If you can make people resistant to the ones you make, then you have longevity. and just anything to do with sports, or in particular, anything to do with perfectionism. I think I'm an anti-eugenicist, and not just because I'm anti-Nazi, but also because I'm anti-pretty. I'm anti-cute. I'm anti-kitsch. Okay, kitsch and fascism run together like best buddies.
And beauty.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think it's really important to, if you're going to go for beauty, think about the difference between a lizard and a jellyfish. Don't think about the best football player in the world. It's getting boring too. Like kitsch is satisfying the most people the most time at any price, right? It's like any way is necessary. So it's like a desperate satisfaction. But also, yeah, just the idea of going ahead and letting go of the human form as being the measure of all things. This is maybe some kind of anti-enlightenment thing. Fuck. Where it's decentering the human centric, deanthropocentrizing. But that comes down actually to being a gifted surrealist. Like, I want to make people covered in eyes. You know, and so what is that? The truth of it is that I just like the uncanny. So I do have an aesthetic. I like, you know, things that make you go, So that's something I'm working on.
Well, it certainly wasn't yuck.
Yeah, the yuck factor. Uh-huh. So yeah, there's that.
Nice. So I was also interested if you can just like super briefly mention that work you did, you know, at TTT, you was there together with that young Russian guy.
Vladimir Stander.
Yeah, so there was some, that was the digital fetus, like 3D kind of thing. What was that?
Well, okay, hold on.
If I'm not jumping too much.
No, that's okay. Well, there's another thing I want to talk about too, but we'll do both. So Vladimir and Julian and Pat and I were working together thinking about the prospects of making a game that helped people understand how to engineer the human genome. Yeah, okay. So I started in digital media and I moved into biomedia because I didn't want to get just into art and computer science. I wanted to get into art in all different kinds of science. There's art in physics. There's art in biology. There's art in astronomy. You know, I mean, but my roots are in digital art. So when I see people taking 3D stuff and throwing it into Unity and making sort of directional sound and, these sort of VR interactive, things, and I say, oh wow, it's getting pretty good. It's getting pretty open access. People can really do this. I got excited and I talked to, a few different people, and we're still trying to figure out whether we can make this game. But Vladimir had studied physics, in Russia, and he sort of moved to Berlin and became a game maker. But a lot of what he does is he has really good physics in his game. He also has an amazing raw aesthetic. He's super experimental, and he's serious about his aesthetics and about what he can do. And so I showed him the process of development in a little bit deeper way. We got together in Amsterdam, and we had a big meeting with Julian and Pat, and he and I sort of talking about how the body forms, because it doesn't form in a linear fashion. It sinks in and then wraps around and then becomes full and then becomes still and then globs form. And then there's sort of an embryonic exhale and there's invagination and there's all these different sort of yogic moves that make a body. It divides into segments, but the segments aren't equal. Buds form, and those buds can turn into arms, but they can turn into one arm or many arms. There's repetition and permutation. And when it comes to manipulating the embryo, there's not enough known really about what Evo Devo is really all about for us to actually be able to completely change every anatomy in every way. But people have figured out how to make antennas turn into legs. People have figured out how to make any cell in a fish embryo that's growing, that's in development, into an eye. They found sort of like the Hox gene or like a Pax gene for eyes, and these master control genes that make eyes. So you can make a fish that's just a ball of eyes. It's true. But I think Vladimir sort of looked at the different developmental stages of embryonic development. And we went from, you know, from zygote on through, and he set up a human embryo that you could just mush with your controllers. Like you'd move your hands around and kind of almost punch it. It was really visceral. And I think he was sort of understanding also my sub message, which is, although embryos are not people, they might have some dignity and there is some heavy handedness to this process. And really, when you add genes, it's kind of surgical, it's kind of poisonous, it's kind of brutal. It's art brute. You know, it's a form of poisonous scalpel art. And so he heard me, and I think he kind of made this embryo that you could biff about, kind of punch out and modulate, cause disturbances. It's almost like, physical manipulation of the embryo, which was like the first 150 years of embryology, was just with the sort of metal scissors and glass pipettes and kind of cutting and pasting, you know, like early Photoshop embryology, but with real embryos. And in this case, he got the picture that a lot of times these are educational embryos. They're considered to be non-beings. Their destiny is death. They're just somatic machines. They are model organisms. They're ancestors that we rape. They're on death row and they're captives and they're kind of like unborn and deformed. And some people call it poor in the world, and they should be extinguished, but not necessarily humanely. And that their behavior is merely responsive, and therefore they're just material or even a factory for future, knowledge. It's all for the public good though, so don't get depressed. Okay? I have another way of collaborating with people, with humans in particular, and that has to do with, when you're doing performance art with people, in particular bio art performance art, where some of the inside jokes of bio art is that it appears to be art and therefore it is some kind of unreal fantasy. Except when you take a closer look, what's actually going on is not fake. It's real and it's positioned as art or artifice, when in fact the joke is that there's nothing fake about it. In particular, when you're working with humans and you're collaborating with them, there are some things like the Nuremberg Convention and the Declaration of Helsinki that have to do with informed consent to be in a medical experiment. So in order to respect co-performers in something that could be determined to be human experimentation as opposed to just art, or both, I came up with a release form that involves informed consent and a few other things. So the first thing is that it's a Creative Commons release form, so that anything that is taken from you during the experiment, whether it's video or photo or sound, or it could be a tissue sample or some genetic sample, or even some germ cells, sperm, eggs, maybe even your child, would be then possibly offered for free through Creative Commons licensing for free without attribution and without any commercial recompense for yourself. So listen, it's a Creative Commons release first. So that means that if you offer yourself up, even your genome, your kin, your future kin, it is possible that it would be available non-commercially online without attribution, which means you wouldn't get any money or any credit. And that's one of the interesting things about Creative Commons, that you can go completely anonymous. So that includes all intellectual property. You're kind of signing it away. But it's also a model release, a medical release, like human research participant release, and a submissive, kind of like in bondage and discipline, kind of S&M submissive contract, or a release of your will, I suppose, in like some sort of sense. So it's a rather long document. It's going into the TTT reader for 2018-19. Basically, it says that you're an explicit model in a porn film and that you're allowing yourself to be deformed, because I found a lot of people have sued if they were shown in bad lights through digital manipulation. So you sign away your rights to digital manipulation. You sign away your rights as a porn artist. And that coincides with a lot of what goes on in bio art when it involves humans. And then you're also letting yourself be medically experimented on in an artistic way. So someone might give you a hormone treatment or try some new reproductive arts or get involved with your birth control or your abortion or your medical data, your biological data, your qualitative, subjective, demonstrative, conceptual, even interpretive data can be sort of stolen. Well, basically you're signing it away to be stolen. So you're being given the right. This is the funny thing about a contract. You are given the right as a human subject to surrender yourself. Now that you have been granted a self, a contract is available to sign it away. This is true of all work contracts, and every single time you hit an I accept button, you know those I accept buttons? Oh man, you reach a contract level with a software company, it's too long to read, and they just have if you want to install it, you have to say I accept, and there isn't any place where you can doctor it or put in your own terms and re-sign it, you know, this sort of thing where you can personalize your contract. It's an impersonal I accept button. All of us have hit it at least 30 times.
Yeah, sometimes it says it can be changed at any time by the company.
Yes. So this is telling. So basically, there are different ways to submit through contract law. And I tried to pick as many of them as possible. So I have, you're releasing your image, you're releasing your ability to stop it from becoming public domain. You're releasing your body and body data, and you're releasing even yourself as a sex object. And in fact, somewhere in this contract, you release yourself completely. Mm-hmm. You allow yourself to be completely subsumed by the contract and be owned by the company almost to the point of the end of humanity. I think that this is in a lot of contracts, but this one's really obvious, and it's pretty funny because it has to do with signing away the entirety of human society, signing yourself away as a piece of work, a piece of artwork.
When you sign yourself away, you're basically signing your offsprings away too.
Absolutely, right? Yes. You're also signing away, like most human experimentation things, you're signing away the right to complain about pain or long-term effects. Right? And in here, I listed so many of them. It becomes like, you know, you should never, ever drive heavy machinery after doing this experiment. It's sort of preposterous, but it's not impossible, sort of like what we were talking about. What's it like to be a transgenic kid? Because basically you were born without signing a contract like this. Your parents signed it for you before you were born. And then you have no ability to complain. You might be able to sue for wrongful life, but it's a long shot. You'd probably be suing your parents, not the technicians they hired. But it's really like the scientists and the technicians, maybe the bioethics boards that are your parents. They sort of decided that you could be born that way. The parents are almost really secondary, like the carriers, the vectors of the children. So I came up with this contract, and I'll read you the name of it. It is the Creative Commons Non-Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike Intellectual Property Explicit Model Release Submissive Human Research Participant License.
Sounds great.
Yeah. And I think it's good. I think actually looking at what's going on in Sweden with contracts before dating or even having sex, I think something like this might be important for your everyday, to get everyone in your life to sign something like this. Basically sign all the rights away so that you don't have to worry about, suing each other for gross negligent affection or anything like that. So, I think it's a helpful license. That's why I'm going to print a copy of it for people to be able to use. So,
did you check it with some lawyers, or did you just collected it and put it together? Or how
I collected it and put it together from like true human experimentation, like, informed consent forms, model releases, quite a few different ones, in particular model releases for like S&M models, contracts that, like contracts between people that like to sign themselves away. And also, yes, like the Creative Commons stuff. And then things about things that are, I sort of feel need to be in there. But one of the things that's in there, it says, if one of these paragraphs doesn't make sense, that doesn't mean the rest of the contract is neutralized. Because there are things in here that I sent some to a lawyer, and he was like, you're not really allowed to do that. There are certain things you can't contract. You can't sign a contract to make yourself a slave of someone else forever.
Because that is a breach of constitution or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's just not available as contract law. In fact, you can't also sign away your life to someone. Like they can't own your mortal ruin. It's yours.
Because there's the hierarchy of laws or something like that.
Yeah. In fact, I remember I went and saw, I think it was Derrida down in Irvine, and he was following Timothy McVeigh, who was on death row, and he said, when you're on death row, you're under 24-hour suicide watch. And the reason for that is because the state has decided to take your life, and so you're not allowed to take your life away from their execution. In other words, like the last thing they can take away from you is suicide. It's like the last right that can be taken is the right to kill yourself. And then you're really without rights. But so some of the things offered in this contract are not legal. But I also designed it because sometimes people have buyer's remorse when they're involved. Most people that get involved in performance art know from the get-go that if they're in the front row, they might get covered in anything. But some people, in particular in pseudo-medical situations or possibly real medical situations dressed up as art, may get to feeling like they were not informed or consenting. And then they may, especially in the U.S., go crazy with the lawyers and start the lawsuits. It happened last week to Hosea Zehner. He got sued for doing like medical experimentation without a license.
On himself.
Yeah. So, and he also sold it for other people to do, but he said he wasn't. You know, blah, blah, blah. If he had had a contract like this, the one thing it wouldn't do, you're never immune to lawyers, but it would tie them up in court for a long time because there's lots and lots of subsections of craziness. And you could represent yourself and drive the other side to 10 styles of bankruptcy, and that's sort of all it takes to beat a lawsuit these days is to tie people up in court. So this is actually made and built to put court in bondage. So this is sort of like legal shibari. Anyway, this will be out and free online through TTT 2018, coming to your internet web. Intermedia net web anytime soon.
Yeah, we will try to link to that.
That sounds good.
After it will be published.
Sounds great. I think that's it, unless you have more questions.
I think that's good.
Okay.
Thanks.
I actually have one question.
Oh, wow.
Because I know a previous version, actually previous versions of that contract, because you use it in other artwork, and when it was connected with Bee Farm, you were very much relating to contracts of people that were being tortured. And it was your critique towards that torture made by the, institution, the legal institution to people in Guantanamo. So I think that's really, really interesting.
Okay, I can speak to that a little bit. Initially, this contract was written for people that were naturally submissive to take the place of prisoners of war, in particular prisoners of war who were being tortured. And I did emphasize Guantanamo Bay because I thought that the S&M community had a higher moral ground than the military. This was when Donald Rumsfeld basically declared that torture was legal. And went against the rules of war in the name of anything goes, basically like postmodern right-wing Republican bullshit.
Well, we're almost back there again.
Oh, we certainly are. Yeah, well, Trump just pardoned someone who was taking endless sniper shots at innocent people just because. So we are in a situation where we are rewarding people for their psychopathologies. As long as it's against perceived enemies, even if they're children, even if you're shooting people in the back, even if they're non-combatants. So the idea was that prisoners of war could be replaced by prisoners of volition. And therefore, if you were torturing them, you would be making them happy. You might even make a profit because they might even want to pay you if they had money. They'd be like, oh, yes, I want to go to Guantanamo Bay. And therefore, people wouldn't be getting tortured. People would be having fun. We'd have an all-volunteer prisoner of war. Here in the U.S., we have all-volunteer army. Why not all-volunteer prisoners of war? And so the idea was that sadomasochism could be an ethical advisory commission to the U.S. Department of Defense, insofar as talking about making things safe, sane, and consensual, as opposed to insane and unconventional and unsafe. Now, I actually think that things can be unsafe and insane as long as they're conventional. I think things can be unsafe and insane as long as they're consensual. But there's just this little thing about lack of consent when it comes to, you know, torturing people that might be innocent. It's so heavy-handed. It's so Kafka-esque. We're so used to it that it's almost like, ignore it again. It's like drone strikes. It just happens. But I'm not totally inured, and I'm not totally convinced it has to be this horrible. So I was trying to look at whether or not it was possible to make torture consensual, you know, and keep it in the realm of respecting human rights. And one of the things that I came up with was this license where you could basically sign yourself into a Guantanamo Bay-like, you know, environment. It's a dark kind of utopianism, but I'm into it. Anyway, did that help?
That sounds great. That is, it's definitely interesting connection.
Well, yeah, I can send you that article too. That one's online, yeah, sure. Somewhere, some protest journal. Yeah. All right.
Cool. Thank you.
So that was Adam at the end with a question from Dalila Honorado, who will be my guest in the next episode. I hope you enjoyed the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast were solely that of the speakers and does not necessarily represent that of the RSci Lab or its employees.